From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. This week on Texas Matters, Julian Castro as he weighs a run for the White House.
I see very clearly that people want a new generation of leadership. You know, they're interested in people from outside Washington, folks that are new faces that are going to bring a fresh perspective to leadership.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies.
Hello, San Antonio! Madam Secretary, I think they like you here.
It was on October 15th, 2015, that presidential candidate Hillary Clinton was in San Antonio and holding a rally with the former local mayor and then current Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Julian Castro.
And through the years, she has always, always been there for us. And today, we're here for her.
The reporting that day was that Clinton was taking a hard look at Castro for the vice president tap. And earlier that day, Clinton said just that.
Well, I think really highly of him, and I am thrilled to have his endorsement today. Both he and his brother, the congressman, are just among the best young leaders in America,
absolutely,
regardless of category or the fact that they come from San Antonio. So I am going to really look hard at him for anything, because that's how good he is.
At an afternoon rally at Sunset Station, Castro endorsed Clinton.
Hillary Clinton is running for president because she has a strong vision for America's future.
And when Clinton spoke to the enthusiastic crowd, Castro was positioned just a few feet to her side. He punctuated her talking points with well-timed nods, applause, and fist pumps.
And when I talk about fighting for comprehensive immigration reform, I mean it must have a path to full and equal citizenship for hard-working, law-abiding immigrant families.
It looked like an audition for the vice president job, and it looked like Castro was nailing it. But later in the timeline, Clinton picked Democratic Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia for the job. Donald Trump won the presidency, Castro exited his cabinet position, and now, as he looks to possibly running for president in 2020, he has released the book. It's a memoir called An Unlikely Journey, Waking Up from My American Dream.
It's an unlikely journey because I don't think anybody would have thought that just two generations after my grandmother got here from Mexico, got to San Antonio as a seven-year-old orphan, losing her parents and coming to the west side of San Antonio and not getting any kind of formal education, really, that one of her grandsons would be the congressman from San Antonio and the other grandson would be the mayor and then in the cabinet. But we see those kinds of stories in the United States in different types of families.
You beat the odds. What would have been a more likely journey for you?
Well, a more likely journey might have been what we see all the time in urban San Antonio or any number of other places. When I was HUD secretary, I visited 100 different communities in 39 states, and I saw a lot of young people and older people with big dreams that were never able to avail themselves of opportunity. And for the neighborhoods and the schools that Joaquin and I grew up in, that was the norm. What we were able to do in going to college and law school and to become a professional, by no means were we, the only ones that did that. There were a lot of other folks that did, but that was not the norm.
Subtitle of the book, An Unlikely Journey, Waking Up from My American Dream. What does that mean?
Yeah, the subtitle is Waking Up from My American Dream, because in each generation in my family, there's been a realization that it's not enough just to work hard as an individual or as a family, that if you wanted the American dream to become real, you needed to push society to get better. And, for my grandmother, she came to San Antonio at a time when you would still see placards on storefront windows that read, "No Negroes, no Mexicans or dogs allowed." she had a real limit to how far that she could go. My mother rebelled against that and was a child of the 60s and a Chicana activist and tried to, you know, do what she could, along with many other folks, to improve our community and our country so that more people could have the kind of opportunity that she could see others already had. And for Joaquin and me, using our time and energy to jump into public service has been a way of making sure that more folks who grew up like we did could achieve their dreams. And so, you know, I think that it, each generation, we woke up to the idea that we have to go beyond just self or family and try and make society better.
You write a lot about your mother, Rosy Castro, in the book. I remember Henry Cisneros, former mayor and secretary of housing and urban development. Thank you. He tells a story about his first day of going to Little Flower in first grade. And that's when he met your mother for the first time. They were both in first grade together. And he says that it was, that was Rosy Castro, fully developed. And it's like she, he has a very clear memory of meeting this very defined first grader, and it had an impression on him.
Yeah, my my mom was an only child that grew up in a very strict household. And she went to Catholic school for all 12 years and then went to a Catholic university there at Our Lady of the Lake. And you know, I think part of her activism was both a reaction to growing up in a very strict household, but really was a reaction to what she saw around her. In the book, I write about, you know, her asking questions, for instance, because Little Flower was in a predominantly African-American and Mexican-American neighborhood. And she would ask, you know, why aren't there any African-Americans here, really, in our class? And so from a very early age, my mother had this sense of wanting equality and wanting justice.
She joined protests against the mayor, Walter McAllister, when he was shown on NBC News saying, and this is in the book, about Mexican-Americans wanting to just grow flowers and they were not really ambitious and they just weren't ready for higher employment. And there was a rash of protest against him for that. And your mother joined in on that and she was actually arrested. Her name was in a newspaper listed not as in a way of reporting the news, but sort of as a way of posting a blacklist of who to avoid in San Antonio.
It was a different time back then. You know, you basically had this infrastructure of elites from the north side of the city, the business community that controlled city government and obviously controlled the local economy. Mayor McAllister at the time represented the pinnacle of that as a very successful businessman that owned San Antonio Savings Associations, but also for, I believe, 12 years was the mayor of the city. And here were these young kids, you know, my mother included, that took great offense at how this mayor that was supposed to represent everybody in the city could go on national TV and could demean half the population, the Mexican-American population, by basically saying that they were lazy and not ambitious when they knew that to be false. When my mother had seen my grandmother go to work every day and clean houses, sometimes even on holidays, so they knew that people were working hard.
In your book, An Unlikely Journey, you know, your story, Julian Castro, here, when you read it from San Antonio, this is all, a lot of it's very familiar. We get it. But this is a national book, and you're kind of doing another national reintroduce to the nation. You did a similar one when you were the keynote speaker at the Democratic National Convention. How do people read this book who have never walked the streets of San Antonio?
You know, San Antonio was always an important part of who I am. San Antonio was the reason that I wanted to get into public service in the first place and was, you know, is still my home today, has always been a fascinating place to me. And my hope is that even folks who are not from San Antonio will kind of get a better sense of how I view our country, you know, why I have the views that I have because of how I grew up on the west side of San Antonio and my family. And also because of the formative experiences as a young city councilman in the early 2000s that I talk about there.
You and your twin brother, Joaquin Castro, congressman, you write about the competitiveness between the two of you, and that was a force that kept you on track. Is that what, how you see that?
Joaquin and I were very competitive growing up. In retrospect, I think that was double-edged. The positive of it was that it made us better in school, and it made us better in sports. Just kind of sharpened us, the competition did. The negative of that is that you grow up always being compared to somebody else, and that's kind of inevitable when you're a twin. The folks who are listening who may be a twin, or if you're a parent or grandparent of a twin, you know that because they look alike, they sound alike, the world treats them the same way, being competitive is very natural. That created over time when we were growing up, at least for me, a kind of looking over your shoulder effect, whether we were competing for grades or competing in sports. The great thing about growing up, about getting older, has been that our relationship has matured from a very competitive one to now one where, you know, we're each other's best support and we're very collaborative. Just like you have a different relationship with your parents when you're 15 versus when you get older and you're 35.
Some have watched both of y'all's careers and have seen that the dynamic between having twins, running for political office, being able to support each other, creating an energy, and also capture the imagination of a constituency. You know, many times y'all have worked with the same constituency. That has been very beneficial to you, particularly when one is out of office, the other one is in office, like now, like Joaquin Castro, he's on the TV all the time talking about what's going on in Washington, D.C., still keeping the Castro name and the Castro brand alive. I mean, do you see, was this just lucky that this happened, or was this designed?
Well, I wouldn't say it was designed. And, you know, I would say that we both grew up in a household where we understood early on the value of participating and doing something to actually try and make the community a better place for people to live, and so that more people could reach their dreams. And, you know, it was, it just felt natural for both of us to think about public service. You're right that, you know, I've been in and out of politics, lost the mayor's race when I was 30 years old, sat it out for 4 years. And now I'm not in any office. Joaquin's continuously been in office since 2003, but we also, you know, we have other interests besides politics and public service. And, you know, we both have families. We both have an older daughter and a younger son. And of course, our wives, Erica and his wife, Anna. So, you know, I try and talk about some of that, you know, my own family in my book, of course, because that's the difference now between when we started and we were, you know, I was 26 versus being 44 and having my own family, and the relationships that you have just change.
So now you're, both of y'all are 44. You can now say that you used to be the future of politics and now you are the now of politics?
Well, I mean, I guess that depends, right? I think Joaquin, in his role as congressman for the 20th Congressional District and somebody who sits on the Intelligence Committee and the Foreign Affairs Committee, is developing very well an expertise in foreign policy. Obviously, he's right at the center of important investigations that are happening now, whether it's the Russian meddling into the elections or other issues. Yeah, I think he has a great path ahead of him. If he wants to stay there, he can gain seniority and have a bigger impact for his district in San Antonio and beyond that. Or in a few years, you know, he may try and run for something else. For me, I'm out of office, and so I'm away from D.C. I'm in San Antonio a lot when I'm not traveling. And I'm going to make a decision about my own future after November.
What are you looking for? What are the indicators that show you that America is ready for a Julian Castro presidential run?
Well, I mean, I've taken the last few months to go and help people that are on the 2018 ballot, because that's the priority, is to ensure that folks win in 2018. But as I've done that, I've gotten a sense of where the country is at, what they're thinking, and I'll continue to do that between now and November 6th. I see very clearly that people want a new generation of leadership. You know, they're interested in people from outside Washington, folks that are new faces that are going to bring a fresh perspective to leadership. Whether I jump into the race or not, I'm convinced that Democrats are going to have great choices in 2020.
When you were serving as the HUD secretary under the Obama administration, you were quoted as saying that you considered HUD to be the Department of Opportunity. What did you mean by that, and do you think it still is?
I called HUD the Department of Opportunity because so much of what it does makes it possible for people to achieve what they want to achieve. You know, nobody can go anywhere in life without a stable place to live. And for a lot of people who are low income or even middle class, it's become very difficult to afford the rent, much less to buy a house. So what we were doing at HUD was making it possible for folks to have a steady foundation in their lives, and therefore making opportunity possible. I don't agree with the direction that the Trump administration has taken HUD in. I don't think they believe in the mission. They wanted to cut the budget by $6 billion, and the only reason they didn't is because Congress didn't let them. So what you have are a lot of state governments, local governments that are having to pick up the slack. You have over 7,000 employees at HUD, career employees that I think are demoralized because they don't think the political leadership believes in the mission of the organization. And so the sooner that we can get past this phase of leadership, the better.
Michael Lewis has written a book, The Fifth Risk, writing about the handoffs on these cabinet departments to the Trump administration, focusing a lot on the Department of Energy, which is a critical department. And he says that many times the people that weren't interested in these handoffs and information about how these departments were maintained. Was there an issue with handing off HUD to Dr. Ben Carson?
Well, you know, I haven't read the book. There was a reluctance to engage at a political level, at least in the case of HUD. You know, I spoke with Ben Carson once before he actually took office in very late 2016, and our team did prepare a lot of information for the landing team, like their transition team. But he also availed himself of his own political and policy advisors. My understanding was that several of the incoming cabinet secretaries also did not engage with the political leadership in place at the time with the Obama administration.
So Dr. Ben Carson talks a lot about personal responsibility and mindset to get someone out of poverty. It's not the government programs that can do it. In your book, An Unlikely Journey, you basically sort of prove that right. I mean, you and your brother Joaquin, through grit, determination, and hard work, are climbing the upward mobility ladder.
Yeah, and there's no question that we worked hard, and my mother and grandmother worked hard, but we also got Pell Grants when we went to Stanford. We got scholarships. We got I was on federal work study at one time. There were Perkins loans. So, you know, the summer before I went to Stanford, also there was a jobs program that I participated in. So there were different ways that an investment from the American people matched my own hard work. And that was the recipe for me being able to achieve my educational success and ultimately my professional success.
Do you think if two twins were born to a single mother today in Westside San Antonio, they would be able to make that same unlikely journey?
Yeah, it might be harder. It might be harder because the commitment that the leadership today, whether in Austin or in Washington, is showing to people of modest means, no matter what their background, is a lot less, I think, than it used to be in some ways. So it might be harder. But I still have no doubt that there are folks right now that are going to make it, and people should be encouraged to work as hard as possible, to study hard, to dream big. And all of us as citizens have an obligation to make our voices heard at the ballot box on November 6th to set a better direction for the state and for the country.
It was 3 years ago this week that in San Antonio you held a rally with Hillary Clinton, and it seemed like it was an audition for you to be her running mate in the run for president. It looked good. It was a lot of excitement, great photographs, great sound bites. What happened?
Well, that VP process, and I write about it in the book, is a very odd process, unlike anything else in American politics, because usually when you're running for office, you know, it's a public thing. You're trying to gain the support of the people who vote for you. In the vice presidential process, you know, traditionally the people who were under consideration, and there were about 10 of us, as I understand it, that were seriously vetted. You're supposed to pretend kind of that you're not interested, not even to talk about the process or the potential to be selected. At the same time, there's sort of this underneath competition that's going on in some ways. And that just, it was an odd process. I think the Clinton campaign ran a very thorough and laudable process, and they came up with a great selection. And I say in the book that Tim Kaine was, I think, a good selection. He had been a governor. He's a senator. He's from Virginia, which was an important state to carry. And the Clinton-Kaine ticket did carry it. And I just saw that as that made sense, both at the moment and also because he was a great candidate.
But the Latino vote didn't really turn out for Hillary Clinton in 2016. Some say, had you been on that ticket, that you would have brought some electricity to that campaign, maybe even a reality check into a campaign that seemed to be unaware of what was going on in America.
Well, who knows? You know, you can never tell. I do think that there's a great young bench among Democrats, and that you're going to see a lot of that in 2020. And one of the things that happened, I think, post-2016 is that it's now possible for the younger generation of Democrats to, you know, articulate their vision and perhaps for some of them to run for president in their own right. And I see that as a great thing.
What do you think went wrong with 2016 for the Hillary Clinton campaign?
You got to start from the fact that she won 2.8 million more votes than Donald Trump, and that it was always going to be tough to keep the presidency, because hardly ever does the same party have it for three terms. Still, of course, there are things that could have been done better in the campaign. I think anybody would acknowledge that, you know, there probably should have been more attention paid to the numbers in Michigan, in Wisconsin, in Pennsylvania. And there's a lot of lessons learned. You know, one lesson is that we got to campaign everywhere with everybody, and that we got to run through the finish line in 2018 and in 2020.
What kind of healing do you think America is going to need in 2020 with whoever becomes president if it's not going to be Donald Trump?
What we're seeing in Donald Trump is the most divisive president in our lifetime. What we're seeing is somebody who is trying to pick and choose who gets opportunity and who doesn't, based on, you know, what your religion is, where you live in the country, a tax bill that rewards folks that have a lot of money and basically penalizes folks that don't. And so the next president is going to have to be focused on uniting the country instead of dividing it, on expanding opportunity instead of contracting it, on a forward-looking vision instead of a vision that looks backward or trying to make something again, like this president does. And frankly, it's going to take, I think, the first 2 years at least to clean up the mess of the executive branch. There have been tremendous number of scandals already among cabinet members and folks that work underneath them. They haven't filled a whole bunch of positions in the executive branch, and so you have chaos at the mid-level and lower levels of people there that are frozen, unable to make decisions, work that's getting backed up, work that's not getting done. So it's going to take a long time, you know, to clean up that mess.
As you said, the majority vote did not go to the president. We have minority rule in the House of Representatives because the way districts are designed, with the majority in the Senate, the majority represents a smaller number of people, population, than the minority. So is that a concern?
Of course that's a concern. It's a concern now because of the consequences of that, like Brett Kavanaugh cementing a long-term right-wing majority on the court. It's a concern because of budgetary decisions that are made all the time that don't reflect the needs of different places around the country. The answer is not, though, to pit, urban versus rural or the people against each other. It's to make reforms that take power out of the hands of the politicians and put that power into the hands of the people. Right now, there are 13 different states that have some form of commission-based redistricting. So they take that out of the politicians' hands, these folks that gerrymander their districts, and they choose their constituents instead of their constituents getting to choose them. And it puts it instead into the hands of a group of citizens that are appointed in a bipartisan way, and it makes things fairer. My hope is that eventually all 50 states will go to some form of a commission redistricting. I hope that eventually we relook at the Electoral College. We've now had two presidential elections in the last 20 years where the person that got the most votes did not become the president. And there's nothing to say that ain't going to happen, in 2020 or 2024 and so forth. That's wrong. That's not what we stand for as Americans.
Have we forgotten that in America, you don't just represent your voters when you get elected. You represent everyone. The president doesn't just represent the people that support him. He's supposed to represent and protect everyone in the country.
Well, there's no question that this president is more divisive, more partisan, and more just aiming for his base than most presidents, at least in the modern era. Whether they were Republican or Democrat, whether you're talking about Barack Obama or Ronald Reagan or whoever, most folks made more of an effort to speak to the entire country. And folks will remember, this started the very first day at the inauguration when Donald Trump gave a very bleak, dark, and divisive speech that just seemed like it was a campaign speech trying to rally his base. Instead of your first speech as the president of the whole nation. And the thing is, it hasn't gotten any better. He hasn't grown in office. In fact, just yesterday he called, the woman that he had an affair with, it paid off, Stormy Daniels, he called her a horse face. I mean, he has debased the office so much, both in his personal conduct and also by treating a lot of the country as if they don't matter. We need to elect a Congress in 2018 and then somebody in 2020 that wants to unite the country and not just divide it. And it's going to try and be a representative or a president for everybody.
Julian Castro is the former mayor of San Antonio, former secretary of HUD, and he is considering a presidential run in 2020. He has written his memoir called An Unlikely Journey, Waking Up from My American Dream. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You can also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. And that's where you can find past Texas Matters programs to listen to. And you can also download us from wherever you get your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.